debilitated. And then she would continue to bleed, and then she would die because of the pain. And I'm asking all the people in the world just to put themselves in my place as a father. And I'm asking them, are you really ready in the future when a Gazan child meets you and maybe in the street, or when you come visit Gaza or visit the cemeteries in Gaza, what would you say to this child? What have you done to protect his family? So you are living in the Western world.
Masab, finally.
And you are, in some way or another, supporting Israel. Yes.
No, please go ahead. Finish.
I mean, you are, in some way or another, you are supporting Israel. You are paying taxes, which is going to, most of the taxes are going to Israel. And I'm really shocked by the American administration. I hope that my voice would reach the American administration people. So, when October 7th happened, you went to Israel. You showed your support. You offered weapons and you offered money. So you were able to do everything. But now you are asking Israel to protect, to minimize the casualties of the civilian, among the civilians. Can you do anything to protect the civilians? So you are calling Israel to minimize the casualties, okay? So what can you do as an American administration to force Israel to abide by the law? Is it really hard for you to stop the carnage, to protect the civilian people, to protect hospitals, to protect shelters, UNRWA schools?
So finally, Masab, what is your message to the U.S., to President Biden, and to European leaders?
Well, I think if you can't stop the war, if you can't stop the carnage, the genocide, just stop financing it. Stop providing more weapons to Israel. Because these weapons are just killing children who are just like your other children. I mean, your children, and you as an American or a European parent, you could be born here in my place in Gaza. Your child could be living in an UNRWA school, in a shelter. They could be bombed in a classroom. And instead of studying and, you know, continuing education, your child could be just sheltering in a classroom, with no teacher, with no books. They are just being educated how to survive, if they could.
Masab, we just have 30 seconds, but were you ever told why you were jailed? You were jailed, I think, that day. About 200 Palestinians in Gaza were jailed. There was a great outcry for you. Do you know if the others were released?
No. I mean, there are a few other people I knew by name because they are from the same town as me, from Beit Lahia. And now it's... So I was kidnapped on November 19th, and now today it's December 7th. Until now, there are other people who are still detained by the Israeli army, and their families are just contacting me. Do you know anything about... I told them I just left. I was just released. I don't have any news about your family. So they are still kidnapped. And the Israelis, by the way, accused me of being a Hamas member. You know, I mean, what a ridiculous accusation. I've been living in America for the past 4 years. And I've been hurt, you know, without... I asked the Israeli captain if they have any photograph, if they have any satellite photo of me holding a weapon or being in any place that could cause any harm to you. And he slapped me in the face. He said, you give me the proof.
Masab Abu Toha, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian poet and author, jailed by Israeli authorities as he and his family fled Gaza. His son is an American citizen. He's a columnist, a teacher, and founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza, also author of the American Book Award-winning book of poetry, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. This is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates at COP28. Our next guest calls this a cabal of oil producers, not a climate summit. We'll speak with the renowned climate scientist Kevin Anderson and find out why he's not here. Stay with us. تفاح نبت بالأرض تفاح ريحة عطر شعرك الفواح ممدود بعينك هالكحل ممدود حناك بن مزخرف ومفروض عابود ودعتك أنا بعابود من حيف انزفك لبحر أسدود مرض Palestinian singer-songwriter Yusor Hamed featuring Maisa Daw. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We're broadcasting from COP28, the United Nations Climate Summit in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Today is a day of rest as the two-week conference reaches its halfway point and negotiations begin. Nearly 200 countries begin to take shape. This is UN Climate Chief Simon Steele.
We can only overcome the climate crisis by ditching business as usual. The win on loss and damage here in Dubai gave this COP a spring in its step. But it is just the start. Now, all governments must give their negotiators clear marching orders. We need highest ambition, not point scoring or lowest common denominator politics.
This comes amid ongoing furor over the COP28 president and UAE oil company CEO's claim that there's no science indicating that a phase-out of fossil fuels is needed to address the climate crisis. Sultan Al-Jaber made the comment during an interview with Mary Robinson, former UN Special Envoy for Climate Change and former president of Ireland. Robinson has since posted on X, formerly Twitter, quote, "A successful COP28 is not about a single individual or nation, but the collective will and concerned efforts of all countries in these negotiations. The science compels. Phase out fossil fuels rapidly, accelerate renewable energy adoption, and radically scale up finance," she wrote. A new report by the Global Carbon Project shows carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels are set to hit a record high this year. According to Oxfam, the richest 1% generated as much planet-warming pollution as the poorest two-thirds of humanity, with private jet travel a key source of emissions.
For more, we're joined by Kevin Anderson, a leading climate scientist, professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester and the University of Uppsala in Sweden. He's a former director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, recently wrote on social media, quote, "This is a cabal of oil producers, not a climate cop. The outcome is known. Crafted rhetoric and lacquered sincerity. Grand announcement with no teeth." Well, I don't know if I have to ask you then, Professor Anderson, why you're not here, but talk about your own lifestyle and the decisions you have made to cut down on your carbon footprint, and then what is happening here and what should be happening here.
Okay. Sometimes I'm quite reluctant to talk about my own lifestyle, but yeah, I've tried to make some changes as a climate academic. So I stopped flying in 2004. I live in a very nice flat, but it's a two-bedroom flat or apartment. I've cut my driving by about 70%. I've been vegetarian since 1987. So I've made some changes, but let's be clear, those changes are in isolation. Those changes are irrelevant. The only merit of individuals making changes is that when we speak to others, we can talk from a position of some understanding of how difficult that is or how easy that is. We know from repeated psychological evidence that that improves or increases the credibility of our arguments. So by making the changes ourselves, that allows us much more scope and potential for changing the system. And that's the important, that two sides of the same coin. System change also requires personal change. They are the same thing. And separating the two, as some people do, I think is usually deliberate by those people who are high emitters. So us high emitters have to significantly change our norms if we are going to be heard and listened to when we talk about system level change. So that's why I've made these changes. I'm not at the COP. Well, for two reasons. One, it's very difficult for me to get there from either from Sweden or the UK without taking a very long time, certainly because I wouldn't be flying. But I'm also increasingly disillusioned as to what merit the COPs have. And I say that with an awareness that many people in the poorer parts of the world say it is important for them because they get their voices heard. And I think that is really true. And Salem Hook, the late Salem Hook, is very sadly no longer with us, so can't attend this year. He has made that point, and I've listened to him on many occasions. But I actually think now that we have heard the voices of poorer communities at the COPs, but we have not listened to them. At some point, hearing is not enough. We have to listen and we have to act. And I think, it's 1992 was the first big Rio Earth Summit. 1990 was the first IPCC report, a third of a century ago. Our emissions, as you've just heard from the Global Carbon Project, our emissions are still going up. This year's COP is overseen by a chair of an oil company. At every single level, these processes have been deeply co-opted. And I don't just mean necessarily by the oil players themselves, but they have changed the narrative of the media, they've changed the funding for research. So they provide the advertising for media, for arts and for sport. At every single level, the tendrils of big oil are changing our society and fundamentally changing our climate. And these COPs have become little more than a scam under which the oil companies and the other fossil fuel companies are hiding that nothing is being done. And so I'm almost in a bit of a state of, I won't say despair, but disillusionment as to where's the right way forward. I think some of the changes in civil society are really important, but I'm very skeptical of these grand events now doing anything other than, providing 2 weeks for the media to talk about climate change, then forget about it for the other 50 weeks of the year.
Well, Kevin Anderson, we'll ask you about where you think the possibility of any kind of change can happen. But if you could speak specifically about the top 1%, and this is not just, of course, in the U.S. or Europe, although principally there, the top 1% of the rich around the world and the percentage of pollution and consumption that they're responsible for relative to the rest of the world's population.
Mm. I think that top 1% is really important. I mean, the numbers tell us that anyway. We know that from the emissions point of view, emissions of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas point of view, that top 1% have a combined carbon footprint that's approximately twice as big as the bottom half of the world's population. I still find it shocking when I say that 1% have a carbon footprint that's twice as big as the bottom half of the world's population. That in itself is appalling and I would say obscene. Remember, it's not just emissions. That will almost certainly hold for consumption of material goods and other forms of environmental sort of detrimental behaviors and so forth. But that 1% also own the newspapers, most of them. They are the senior people in our policymakers, in our companies. They are the senior academics. They're the vice chancellors of our universities. So that, and I use the word almost pejoratively, I suppose, that elite group frame the whole climate change and broader ecological debate. And they have framed it in a way that has supported them, supported us. We are unprepared to ask the questions that would, you know, would be difficult for us to think about in relation to our own norms and lifestyles. So we have deliberately twisted everything in society to fit with that particular worldview, that particular paradigm, which the physics doesn't give a damn about. The temperature will just keep going up. We can scam everything as much as we want. As the Global Carbon Project pointed out, the emissions will go up again this year. And we can have all these fine speeches and all these other things out there, but the temperature will keep rising. People will start to get seriously damaged or impacted in the global north, as they are already in the global south. Let's be very clear about this. Climate change is not a threat for many. It's a daily reality. People are dying. Communities are being fractured. Their livelihoods are being lost as a consequence of the emissions that we in the global north, particularly that 1%, have knowingly imposed upon them and are carrying on doing so. And that's why the scam and the language around the COP 28, to me, is deeply disturbing when we consider what is actually happening and what we are locking in, even for our own children's future. Do we have so little concern for our own children's future that we are prepared to scam these COPs, scam the whole climate change agenda, just to maintain our comfortable, overly comfortable way of living, this top 1%, of which will include, as I say, most of the so-called elites in our society.
Dr. Anderson, we just have 30 seconds, but you have said there are now no non-radical futures. The choice is between immediate and profound social change or waiting a little longer for chaotic and violent social change. In 2023, the window for this choice is rapidly closing. Your final comments.
We have to recognize that responding to climate change needs a sort of Marshall-style plan in terms of technology, so rapid rollout of technology, low-carbon technologies that exist today. But that in itself now is too late. Alongside that, we have to have fairness and equity in there. The maths of the Paris Agreement and the IPCC science tell us that equity, fairness, is a prerequisite of delivering on our Paris commitments. So technology and fairness have to go hand in hand.
Kevin Anderson, leading climate scientist, speaking to us from Uppsala, Sweden, where he is a professor of energy and climate change, as well as at the University of Manchester, former director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. We'll link to your articles. Coming up, Nigerian climate activist Nimo Bassi here at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai. Back in 30 seconds.
Eyes are red, but you're high and I'm crying. You're trying to forget, but it hits me every time. You pray next to me, right hand holds your left sleeve, turning our heads gently, cause when it ends we fight. And in that warm winter I withered, I just wanna get better. I'll be what you like. Whose Lord are you naming when you start to break things? It's my only life you hold. And when you left me waiting, I thought, did you do it in the name of God?
Name of God by Mustafa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're broadcasting from COP28, the United Nations Climate Summit in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, where there is a day of rest today. So we're among the only ones, along with the workers in this vast facility in Dubai and the expo, that are here.
This week, protesters from Africa gathered at the entrance of COP28 with the call to make the polluters pay. This is Ina Maria, a frontline climate activist from Namibia. But first, Bekumi Dean Bebe with PowerShift South Africa.
The people united will never be defeated.
The people united will never be defeated.
I said the people united will never be defeated.
The people united will never be defeated.
Have turned this entire expo into a crime scene, which is why we see this. The injustices are undeniable. They are as undeniable as what has been said about the climate science. It's clear, and we're witness here. We feel the impacts more than anyone across the world. The droughts are clear. The famine is clear. The flooding is clear across Africa. The 600 million people without energy access is clear. The 900 million people in Africa without cooking alternatives is clear. We want justice now, and we refuse energy colonialism. We want climate justice now.
When you walk out of this area, just think for yourself, is this just that your banks, your financial institutions continue to subsidize these climate criminals, because that is what they are. Tomorrow, when you find your house underwater, just think, who were the institutions supporting? Were they institutions, the people that are being criminalized, like our late Kansara Wiwa? We are your ancestors, we are you, and we are telling you right now, make polluters pay!
No!
Make polluters pay!
No!
Make polluters pay!
No!
Climate activists from Namibia and South Africa, but now we head north. That last reference to Ken Sarawiwa, a remarkable climate activist in Nigeria, leading writer who was killed by the state of Nigeria. We're joined now by Nimo Bassi, a man who knew him well, a longtime Nigerian environmental activist and poet who is here in Dubai, director of the Health of Mother Earth Foundation. It's great to have you back, Nimo. In one of these climate summits, you were arrested. I can't remember which one. Here, there is protest within the bounds of the UN summit. It's not allowed outside. We're in the United Arab Emirates. If you can talk about what is happening here and what you think needs to happen.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the arrest that happened in Copenhagen at COP15. And that was when we were insisting that anything more than 1 degree Celsius temperature increase was setting Africa on fire. And now we're here celebrating 1.5, which is being missed already. My thinking was that coming to this COP, the negotiators would take note of the United Nations Environment Programme's Emissions Gap Report, which came out just a couple of days before the COP. That report showed that if countries do all they said they're going to do as nationally determined contributions, the world would be set for 2.9 degrees Celsius temperature increase above pre-industrial level. That would mean about 4 degrees for Africa and for some other regions. But here we've seen that right from day one, the agenda of the COP appears to be, the COP appears more like a carbon trade fair. It's like people are making deals rather than talk about how to cut emissions at source. I'm not really very disappointed about this because I didn't expect it to be anything different. If you have, as we've heard, as we know, an oil company executive leading the COP is already compromised.
It's one of the largest oil corporations in the world, ADNOC, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Corporation, Sultan Al-Jaber, who is the head of this COP.
Yes, and, we've heard so many things going on, and with the fossil fuel industry being so prominent here, with bankers crawling the spaces of the COP, we're seeing a lot of trade discussions. And, you know, this breaks my heart when I look at the way African negotiators or policymakers, the politicians, are bending back and accepting whatever has been thrown at them by those who are investing in carbon offsetting or carbon trading mechanisms. We're seeing a sellout of African continent. And we know the implications for this. For one, it means once you sit out a territory for a period of time, you've lost sovereignty, more so to speak, over that place, over that forest, over that community, over that territory. And then you, it means negative impact on communities who live in the area that you are sitting. We're talking about millions of hectares being mapped out to be sold for carbon credit generating facilities. And, you know, some of this means reforestation or afforestation. It means clearing the land and planting new trees. Now, that itself emits, releases a lot of carbon from the soil. And then, of course, these new trees are monocultures, and they're not as efficient carbon sinks as natural forests. And so we're seeing losses on in every dimension.
So if you could elaborate on that, Nima, what precisely is being discussed here with respect to carbon trading and the purchase of large tracts of land in many parts of Africa, in particular by this Emirati company, Blue Carbon? But it's by no means the only company to be doing this.
Right. I think the COP has continuously been opening up the space for this kind of false climate solutions. And it's all embedded in Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which allows for false solutions like carbon offsetting, like geoengineering, carbon capture and storage. These are things that allow polluters to keep on polluting without cutting emissions at source. And so we're having corporations like the one you mentioned advancing to many African countries, to Liberia, into Kenya, into everywhere, Zimbabwe and the rest. And they're investing quotes into large tracts of land. And it's really scary, some of the things we're hearing. We're hearing some countries may steal up to 20% of their landmass, many of them 10%. And of course, we heard about a Nigerian state that also has signed a memorandum of understanding to steal out about close to 800,000 hectares of land. This is very disturbing. It's really disturbing. This is like green colonialism. We've heard that over and over. This is clear example of selling off territories for a mess of porridge.
And finally, Nimo, if you could talk about, you're one of Nigeria's leading environmental activists. You have been for decades. What are the implications of the decisions taken here for Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa and also its biggest oil producer?
You threw in the oil aspect. Well, Nigeria is a very important country on the African continent for size and population and for this kind of energy conversation. In fact, we always point people, those who want to open up new oil wells, to look at Nigeria to understand why they should not go that way. Because the energy, there's a lot of energy expansion in Africa, in Okavango, in Uganda, in the Solom Delta, in Senegal. Everywhere you look, new oil or gas fields are being opened. And they're open for export, not for use of the resources on the continent. And so it's all about money. And without any care about the people, about the environment. And so in the case of Nigeria, this particular way, the Nigerian government right now is very, very excited about carbon trading, about carbon market. They're following the examples of Kenyan government and others. And it's all about trying to attract resources, financial resources, without considering the impact on the communities, without considering the impact on the climate. And, of course, we have a very peculiar system in position in place in Nigeria with gas flaring continuing. And, in fact, one particular oil well that blew up 3.5 years ago is still burning as we speak.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. This is a conversation that we will continue. Nimo Bassi, longtime Nigerian environmental activist, poet, director of the Health of Mother Earth Foundation, author of several books, including Oil Politics and To Cook a Continent, Destructive Extraction and Climate Crisis in Africa. In 2010, he received the Right Livelihood Award. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Noam Chomsky. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh here in Dubai.
Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we hope you have a joyful Hanukkah and a happy new year.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.
You are listening to